All right, you ready to go, counsel?
May it please the court, counsel. I am Charles Mihalik. This is my co-counsel, Kate Baird. We represent the appellant Ortega in this matter. We are requesting a new trial, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for my rebuttal.
Mr. Haley, before you begin, don't charge him with this time. I want the parties to know that the court is very concerned about the delay that has taken place in completing the resolution of this case here. We have been trying to catch up in a number of areas. Our processing has resulted in some cases being transferred to be handled in one way, and then later we discover, after we've looked at them more deeply, that it's appropriate for us to take a further look, which precipitated argument in this case. So we apologize for the jump start and what seems to be go and not go, but we thank you very much for your patience, and we'll do our best to move this along as quickly as possible.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. And actually, this is timely because we know that the Supreme Court is now looking at the rules of civil procedure and some adjustments. So I think having argument in this particular matter is important. The relevant facts are pretty simple. There's an accident that happens in 2011. The plaintiffs have medical care that's pretty conservative. They stopped treating about March through May of 2012. The complaint is filed in August of that year, and the plaintiffs are deposed in November of 2013. Between the stopping of medical treatment in 2012 in May through November of 2013, there is no medical care. After the depositions occur, the plaintiffs go back for a medical treatment to see Dr. Lance Kalski and Dr. Kaplan, and then again, no treatment for a year. Discovery closes June 20th, 2014. At no time during discovery did the plaintiffs provide a computation of damages for future medical care pursuant to NRCP 60.1. There was the initial joint case conference report. There were supplements on past medical care, but there was never a computation on the future. And there's two lines of authority that we are citing in our request for a new trial. The first line is the federal cases. These are the Walmart line of cases. And they say basically that if you do not provide a computation of future damages, then you should not be able to request those damages at trial. Future care should be stricken. And the second line goes to this court's opinion in FCH1, Rodriguez, that's the Palms matter, where the court said if you are a treating physician, that you cannot testify outside your care and treatment unless you provide a report. And the doctors in this case were not experts, they were simply treating physicians, and there was no report provided as to a computation of the future surgery. So let's turn to the federal court cases. So NRCP 16.1 is patterned after the federal rules, and we know under the federal rules that it's strong persuasive authority of how this court should interpret NRCP 16.1. And the rule says that a plaintiff must provide a computation. If the plaintiff doesn't have to provide a computation of future damages, then the rule is meaningless. It should not be upon the defendant to figure out what the scope of damages the plaintiffs are requesting. And that's the federal cases, the Walmart cases, Calvert versus Ellis. They all hold the same way, that it's not incumbent upon the defendant to determine the plaintiff's damages. They must tell us. And secondly, there's the discussion about the future surgery. And the federal court cases say, well, even if there is a notice of an upcoming surgery, that still does not comply with the rule. You must tell us what the damages are. So notice of an upcoming surgery is insufficient. And I will state that when I refer to the facts is because we weren't on notice of an upcoming surgery anyway. The plaintiffs had a year and a half of no medical treatment, then a couple of months, and then another year of no treatment, and then discovery closes. We are at the hearings on the motions in limine, which we filed to exclude future damages, and the plaintiff still hasn't said they're going to have future surgery. In fact, Mr. Cervantes-Lopez says at trial that he doesn't want surgery. And same with Mr. Varga. Mr. Varga says, well, I've learned to live with my pain.
So I'm curious while you're on that point, you brought the motion in limine to exclude the evidence of future damages at trial. And apparently the judge denied that motion and said that you can revisit it later once the trial started. What was the basis for her denial at that time? Did she give one?
Sure. There was a, at the time of the motion in limine, the plaintiff had not said definitely one way or another whether they were going to have surgery. But the Judge Miley felt that the burden should be placed upon the defendant to ask the right question.
And well, and that's something that bothered me at some point during discovery. There was an indication by her that it was incumbent upon the appellant to ask questions during the neurosurgeon's deposition regarding the surgery, which to me indicated a burden shift.
Right, and NRCP 16.1 that places the burden on the plaintiff, not on the defendant. And we asked Dr. Kaplan whether he had a cost letter, and he said no. So if there was hypothetically a burden, we asked that question. Now, let me turn to the second portion of that, because under FCH1, the Palms matter, there has to be a expert report that should be given to the defendant. If you're going to testify outside of your care and your treatment, then you need to provide an expert report. And in the Palms matter, it was the plaintiff's physicians, Kidwell and Shannon, who testified outside their care and treatment. In fact, Dr. Shannon testified about another provider's medical care and that it was reasonable and related and necessary to the accident. The same way Dr. Coca testified about Dr. Koppel's medical care and treatment, and that was reasonable and necessary. That was error because there was no expert report provided. And I don't think that the raising the potential of maybe a surgery that the plaintiff does not want rises to the level of a reasonable certainty of future damages. Nor do I think that that type of testimony is found within the opinion of a care and treatment of the plaintiff. So he didn't, Dr. Kaplan did not provide that opinion until trial. He was not asked by the plaintiff until the middle of trial what the computation of damages was. And when we got it, all we got was a number, $260,000. There was no breakdown of what the amount would be. And although I attempted, and Mr. Baird attempted, to mitigate that prejudice, it was impossible because Dr. Duke could not testify as to the reasonableness of those medical bills. And my expert, my other expert, Tammy Rockhold, had been precluded by the trial court.
Dr. Duke got to actually address the codes that pertain to certain procedures that your other expert was going to testify to, right?
Yeah, here's what happened. So we gave Dr. Duke Tammy Rockhold's analysis.
Yes.
And he basically said, these are the numbers as to the past medical care. But that was it. He had no foundation. He was relying, as an expert can rely, upon another expert's report. But he had no foundation he could tell the court or the jury. As to the futures, he had no knowledge whatsoever. Mr. Simon cross-examined him, and we've outlined that in the brief, because the problem, Dr. Duke had no way to dispute what the surgical cost was, the hospital care, you know, future physical therapy. There was simply not enough time for him to look at it. And of course, I did not have Ms. Rockholt do that because those numbers were never produced during discovery. Regarding Ms. Rockholt, let me go back for a second. The rule under 37 should be self-executing. If there was a lesser sanction than exclusion, it was upon the plaintiff to try and show that the failure was harmless or whether there was some justification. That didn't happen. The court never found that issue because they placed the burden improperly upon us to ask the right question. Regarding Ms. Rockholt, The objection was that somehow she was involved with insurance, and that's just not the case. Ms. Rockhold is a nurse out of Oregon, and what she does is she has a database that she looks at that determines the reasonable cost of medical care. In fact, that database is the same database that Dr. Coca utilized at trial to find his own bills reasonable and necessary. So this database has been tested, it's been used nationwide. Dr. Coca said, yeah, I know my bills are reasonable because I fall in the correct percentile. And what it is there's a percentage range of everybody's bills, and let's take a 50 percentile medium, 50% would be above, 50% below. So you can look at that data, and you can determine whether your bill falls within a certain range. Dr. Coca could do that. He was allowed to use that information and testify. McRocco, using the same information, was not allowed to testify. And so not only could I not dispute the future care, I could not dispute the past medical bills because we were relying upon her to do that. Like you said, Dr. Duke did say it, but all he could give was a number. He could not give any substantive opinion to that.
And my understanding is you're not challenging the past pain and suffering.
To the extent of the failure to provide the computation of damages, that is correct. So, although I would say that the future pain and suffering and the future medical expenses are linked together, there would never have been that high of future surgical costs, $200,000 to Mr. Lopez, $85,000 to the plaintiff, had they not had that testimony in, and then, of course, that number affects what they would get for future pain and suffering. But I do think that we are entitled to a new trial because of the Rockhold error and the other errors that were there. We had, under Leoch, we had some arguments that I think were improper. The plaintiff essentially told the jury that their verdict can make the papers if it's high enough. He told the jury that Ms. Ortega was avoiding responsibility. There were a litany of insurance issues that came up. I moved for a jury instruction twice and eventually for a mistrial because it seemed every day the mention of insurance was coming in. So although the computation only applies to the futures, I think there are sufficient errors on the past as well. Although I still think that we would be entitled to a new trial in any event. I don't want a remitter of the future damages. I want a new trial, and I think my defendant's entitled to that. And I will reserve the remaining 3 minutes and 20 seconds for rebuttal.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your time today. I'd just like to start off that they want a new trial. They don't want remediator. They don't want any other remedy. They want a new trial. So if we're going to ask for a new trial, they have to come and ask you based on the law of the state of Nevada. The judge, in this case, got it right. Judge Miley was very careful in all of her analysis and evaluation of all the objections. They objected to everything during the entire course of the trial, hoping something would stick. And in this case, Judge Miley was very conscious of the Palms case that recently came down. And I think the timeline is really important for the justices when evaluating this case. I have been practicing prior to this case 23 years and have tried many, many jury trials. My disclosures have always conformed to the Supreme Court decisions and the NRCP rules. When this discovery closed was in June of 14. The first Palms case didn't come down until July. And then the second one, I believe it was in October. So discovery had already closed, but in my disclosures, I told them during the course of discovery that my doctors, including Dr. Kaplan, would act as an expert. He would talk about the necessity of future cost. And then when the Palms case came down, Judge Miley was very conscious about that. And she said, you're only going to talk about whatever is in those medical records. If it's not discussed in the medical records for the treatment of the doctors, you're not going to get into it. And she shut me down on a lot of different places throughout that entire trial. And for example, Dr. Kaplan was going to testify because this kid is a 27-year-old kid who needs surgery. He's going to ultimately need a second fusion in his life due to an adjacent segment breakdown. That was not in the medical records, and Judge Miley said, you're not getting into that. Similarly, Dr. Lanskowski had a lot to offer these people because they were young, and he was going to talk about injections and surgery center costs, and she said, you're not getting into it unless it's rooted in the medical records, which is the evidence in this case. And the entire, every single treating physician that came through that courtroom testified what was based in the medical records only. And she wouldn't let anybody get out of the area of her expertise. So as far as the timeline, what's really going on here on this appeal?
Sir, I'm sorry, was the cost figure for this proposed future surgery was not in the records, is that correct?
That was not in the records. And I would submit to you that because the treating physicians are non-retained experts, 16.1 has never required precision from treating physicians, and they don't require reports from treating physicians. And so what happened was in this case, we disclosed that they had that this particular person needed the surgery. The specific type of surgery was put in the medical records. It was an L5-S1 fusion. And so the testimony of Dr. Duke at Appellate's Appendix 1154 is, so did you know that Dr. Kaplan testified that Christian was a surgical candidate at L5-S1? I read his report, but you knew that before coming here today, right? Correct. And you just disagree with him, right? Correct. Dr. Duke knew about this surgery 8 months before trial, 3 months before the discovery cutoff. Dr. Duke is a neurosurgeon that practices in the same specialty. Dr. Duke could come up with a number that he think is reasonable for the surgery long before we ever got there. The whole idea of costs have to be disclosed and spoon-fed to the defense. It has to be evaluated by the judge in each particular case. And I know that they've cited some federal court decisions.
That was 16.1 expects.
Excuse me?
I don't think that's what 16.1 expects.
As is what, I'm sorry?
16.1 expects you to produce that information. You have the burden on damages.
We have the burden on damages, but 16.1 does not explicitly state that future costs need to be produced to the other side in a form or a document. What it means is, and I think you guys gave some great guidance in Palms, is that all this is about surprise, that they don't want to have surprise at trial. And what surprise is about is that they know the information that's going to be presented at trial. And
well,
they
what, and that brings me to a question on 16.1A1C, requiring a party to produce without awaiting a discovery request the computation of any category of damages claimed. And that was never done, and there's a continuing obligation to supplement. How do you explain that?
Because at the time, the norm was past medical specials that you're going to present, as well as any lost wages, are to be the items of damages that are disclosed. Future medical costs, because their estimates aren't precise, and we can't give those exact numbers. And that was the idea of 16.1 and how it was treated in practice back in the time before the POMS came out. Certainly people now are putting in what they believe in the abundance of caution. And that's why it's within the discretion of the court. Because what's truly important here is that the defendants knew the entire time, well within the discovery period, that this person was a surgical candidate. And when they talk to you about, well, he wasn't scheduled for surgery and surgery wasn't certain, that's not the law. The law is, to a reasonable degree of medical probability, is this person a surgical candidate to have this in his life? That's all I need to prove. And I proved that at trial. And what happened is we disclosed that. Their expert had it. They go and take Dr. Kaplan's deposition. In the deposition, they confirm that he's a surgical candidate. And I'd just like to say that they misstate in their brief that he didn't testify to a reasonable degree of probability that he would need it. He did testify to a reasonable degree of probability in the deposition that he would need it. But then they ask, well, do you have a cost letter in his deposition? And so he said he's not sure, and he didn't have one, but they didn't ask him, well, what is the cost of that surgery? And so Justice Perry-Gary, you said, well, that sounds like burden shifting. And I submit to you that it's not burden shifting. It's about discovery. And they never wanted the information about the price. We're just talking about the price that is well known to these lawyers, to their insurance company, to Dr. Duke. They know what a cost of an L5-S1 procedure is. It's very common. But they didn't want to know because they'd rather have the issue. And how do I know? Either they knew and didn't have to ask, or they wanted the issue. And we know they wanted the issue because they raced to the court on a motion in limine, saying they never produced the cost. And we want the cost, and all the future damages should be thrown out because they didn't fill out a form. Well, I submit to you that that's not fairness, and that's why trial judges have discretion. And under 37C, Judge Miley made findings and used her discretion. She could have kept it out, but she chose not to. And what she did in the situation is she cured any prejudice because she allowed Dr. Duke to testify to numbers. And Dr. Duke, on the stand, gave a lower number of $80,000. This verdict and the future cost was disputed. Neurosurgeon versus neurosurgeon. They got a fair trial. And to overturn this this verdict, they have to say that Judge Miley abused her discretion. And she didn't, because there was no surprise. It was in the medical records. They know the cost. And under the Palms case, it was in the medical records. So it was fully disclosed. So on those points, I don't know if there's anything else in the appeal. There's a lot of issues that were kind of just thrown up against the wall. I don't know if there's anything else that the justices are concerned about. I'm happy to address any and all of them.
Would you want to address the misconduct allegations and your point of view on those?
Yeah, my point of view is that during the entire trial, they didn't want me to speak. They didn't want me to speak in opening. They didn't want me to speak in closing and were objecting. And they would say things that I didn't actually say. And so I'll give you a few examples here. For example, in their brief at page 23, they say, during both opening and closing, plaintiff's counsel disparaged Dr. Duke as an expert for sale who will say anything once paid. If you look to the record, I never said who will say anything once paid. What happened was I asked Dr. Duke if he provides a service. He answered yes. And that's a service that you charge the defendant for. Yes. And that's a service for your time. Yes. So you provide services that are for sale because they pay you for your service. That's all that was said. I never said that he's a hired gun. I never said he's bought and paid for. I never said that he'll say and do anything. And so they say things in their brief that I didn't say. And so when we talk about the newspaper, they have an issue with the newspapers. Yeah, verdicts are read. Verdicts are read. They're published in the trial reporter. Some verdicts do hit the newspaper. All I was doing is reminding this jury of their duty, their charge, and how important their decisions are, and that people, it's not a meaningless decision. And I wanted them to put thought and effort into their decision and not compromise this claim. I wanted them to rely on the evidence and give, and they tried to suggest that I wanted jury nullification. I never once said in any of my closing that I wanted this jury to reject the evidence and render a decision that was outside the evidence.
And I guess that's some of the...
If I could just interrupt,
yes.
Returning to your point a moment ago. My understanding is that Volume 3, 465 to 66 of the record, quotes you as saying the following. Dr. Duke is a retained expert by the defendants. He is a neurosurgeon, does spine surgery, but what you'll learn is his services are for sale. Did you say that?
I did say that. And that was the testimony straight from Dr. Duke's mouth. So, I mean, it's not that I was saying that he's bought and paid for, or I'll say and do anything. All I said is that he provides a service to the defense and that it is for sale because he charges for it. And he admitted to that on cross-examination on the stand.
Could you also confirm this? My understanding from the record is that you made disclosure for the first time of the future costs for surgery the night before the husband's neurosurgeon testified, and that the following day at trial, over appellant's objection, your treating neurosurgeon testified, the husband's treating neurosurgeon testified, that the cost of a lumbar surgery would be roughly $224,100. Is that accurate?
As far as disclosing the amount to the defense, yes, that's accurate, but that's the first time that the defendant actually asked for a number. And the reason for that is they didn't want a number. And so, for example, you've been a little bit misled in the briefing because they want to say that they asked for it in interrogatories early on to a lawyer that had the case before me. They never asked for the cost in those interrogatories. They asked for about procedures. The procedures were disclosed.
And your view is of this subject is that pre-Palm, a lawyer in your position handling a case like this in Clark County was not under any obligation to make any discovery disclosure of this cost, whether asked or not.
Not as the computation of damages. Practitioners, the norm was to give past medical specials, past lost wages, but as far as projected future estimates, we did not do that. Post-POMS, you guys provided guidance. The bar on both sides has responded to that, and now everybody does it in an abundance of caution. But even in POMS, you never talked about that costs of future care needed to be provided. And that's never been stated in any case. And what I would submit to you that if, in fact, you're going to give guidance, it shouldn't be at the expense of throwing this trial away and starting over. Because just like you did in the Corey case, you gave guidance there, but you didn't throw the trial out. And we are always open to guidance. And we do that now. But as far as throwing the trial out, Judge Miley carefully looked at this under 37C and exercised her discretion. And quickly, even post-trial, Judge Miley looked at this. And they didn't offer any declaration from Duke to show that it would be any different, the outcome. The reason is that his charges are the same as Kaplan. He knows what the charges. And they haven't shown that their substantial justice has been, or their rights have been denied, because it wouldn't have been any different. They haven't shown anything that the outcome of the trial wouldn't be any different. In fact, this jury gave me less money than I asked for. They didn't give me any loss of enjoyment of life. They gave me less than the pain and suffering I asked for, both past and future. So this, when asking for a new trial, they need to show that this jury didn't rely on the evidence. And this jury did. And if I could just have 1 minute, because I would like to address just the federal court cases just for a moment, if I could.
I think we understand your position.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just say that Mr. Simon is very competent counsel. So if he had found any federal court case that would have reversed the burden and placed it upon the defendant, he would have addressed it. There was no case that he cited either here or in his briefs. And if he's going to rely upon the Palms decision, well, the Palms decision came out in 2014, and we were arguing that in front of Judge Miley. At what point after Mr. Simon saw the Palms case did he provide a computation of future damages? None. It wasn't until the middle of trial. So if he was concerned about Palms and saw that and said, well, I should maybe produce something, he still didn't do it. Let me go to the precision. He says, well, the treating physicians don't need to be precise in their medical records. Well, that's why we exclude everything, their opinions that aren't in the medical records. And the problem is not that the doctors didn't provide a computation, it's that nobody did. Not any of the doctors, not the plaintiff, at no time for either of them. And if the doctors aren't going to say it, then he needs to say it. He needs to give me a computation of damages. It was never done. And the rule is clear. The rule says you must do it. If you don't do it, it should be excluded. Let me address the Dr. Duke issue because...
Well, what's your position with respect to counsel's argument, though, that in the motion for new trial and in remitter, no declaration was tendered to demonstrate that the cost would have been different than what testimony had been placed before the jury?
Sure. In the brief, I cited to the testimony of Dr. Duke what he said. Mm-hmm. I could not come up with the numbers. There was no, at that point, that was the testimony. I didn't have a juror affidavit that could have questioned them as to whether that would have made a difference in their mind, and I didn't think it was appropriate to try and shoehorn in additional evidence that I did not get at trial. The fact is that the plaintiff must show that I was not prejudiced. They have the burden to show either justification or no prejudice. It's not upon me to give an affidavit to the court and say, oh, look, here I was prejudiced. They have to prove that I was not prejudiced. And at trial, Dr. Duke could not dispute the numbers. Even if I had tried, and I don't know if that would have been appropriate for me to try afterwards. Certainly Ms. Rockholt, I was prejudiced because if I had had her at trial, I could have used her information to dispute those numbers as well, but I could not do so. Dr. Duke.
But, sir, her information came in through Dr. Duke.
The number of the past came in through Dr. Duke. But that's like giving an opinion as to Carolina's going to win the tournament and just saying that and not giving you any foundations to why that opinion has grounds. Mr. Simon tore Mr. Duke apart on cross-examination because Mr. Duke had no foundation to dispute the numbers. He said, oh, I don't know this. I don't know that. I can't say that. It could have been easy for me to simply tell Dr. Duke, just take 25% off the numbers. Just go ahead and fudge. But Dr. Duke told the truth. He said, I don't know. That's prejudice. And during opening, counsel had a list of dollar signs. If I may finish my thought, Your Honor.
I think we understand your position. Did you have any additional question, Justice Stiglitz? All right. Thank you very much for your argument, sir. And Mr. Simons, you as well. We appreciate your arguments, and the case will stand submitted.